Today is Thursday, April 22nd, Earth Day, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. A U.S.-based analyst says the death of Chad's president will have direct repercussions for neighboring Sudan's Darfur region.
His disappearance will create destabilization in Chad, and that destabilization is expected to affect the entire region.
Plus, Russian police have rounded up more than 1,000 people protesting against the detention of Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny. All of these stories and more next. A U.S.-based analyst says Sudan's transitional government must remain neutral towards the political developments in neighboring Chad. Observers say the sudden death of Chadian President Idriss Deby may increase instability in the entire Sahel region, which could spill across the border into Sudan's Darfur region. Nabil Biagio is up first.
Analyst Suleiman Baldo says President Deby's death will have direct repercussions for Darfur, since Deby played a key role in fighting terrorism in the Sahel region. He says Deby's absence causes a security vacuum that could pose serious consequences for Chad, Darfur, and beyond.
Idriss Deby has been a trusted military ally of France in policing the Sahel region. He deployed fighters from the Chadian army to fight several jihadist groups in the north of Mali, Boko Haram in Nigeria and in Cameroon, and also supported the movements in Darfur region of Sudan. His disappearance will create destabilization in Chad, and that destabilization is expected to affect not only Darfur, but the entire region.
Baldo points out that Deby supported armed groups in Darfur in their fight against former President Omar al-Bashir and his administration. He says due to the ethnic connections between communities in Chad and in Sudan's Darfur, political instability in Chad could quickly spill over into Darfur and possibly ramp up the on-again, off-again intercommunal fighting between Arab groups and the Masalit in West Darfur.
Additional destabilization in Chad is going to add oil on this fire. We have seen it in the recent attack in April on Al Jineina, capital of West Darfur. The governor basically accused militiamen coming from Chad of having joined their ethnic kin in West Darfur to attack the settled Masalit and the displaced Masalit who were congregated in Jineina. So that kind of situation is likely to continue, and a main factor actually is that Darfur communities, Darfur people have ethnic extensions in Chad and vice versa.
Baldo says whatever happens on one side of the border affects the other. He says Sudan's government must remain neutral to the military takeover in Chad following Deby's death. He says the military takeover is likely to increase tensions with Chadian political opposition as well as armed rebels who were advancing on the capital in N'Djamena, where Deby was killed on Tuesday, according to the Chadian military.
It should encourage the Chadian actors to adopt a model similar to that of Sudan, where there is de facto a power-sharing arrangement between the army, the civilians, and the population that are pressing for a democratic transition in the country and a return of civilian rule.
Baldo says a peaceful transition of power in Chad would have a positive impact on Sudan's Darfur region.
The government of Sudan should be very careful not to be drawn into the situation in Chad, and on the contrary, to encourage peaceful and lasting solutions to ensure the stability of Chad by giving all all principal players a role in the transition and distribution of power that keeps all actors relatively satisfied that they have a responsibility in shaping the political future in Chad. Otherwise, it is the entire region that will be at risk of destabilization as a result of the sudden death of Idriss Deby.
Chad's military took control of the government yesterday after Deby's death, dissolved his government and parliament, and unilaterally announced an 8-month transitional period, a move which Baldo says will increase military and political tension in the North Central African nation. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Washington.
The day after the battlefield death of President Deby, rebels from the Front for Change and Concord in Chad, also known by their French acronym FACT, are vowing to keep pushing southward towards the nation's capital. Meanwhile, Chad's newly established military council faces questions about whether it's constitutional. Now, to discuss the latest developments, VOA's Jason Patinkin reached out to Richard Moncrief in Nairobi. Moncrief leads the International Crisis Group's Central Africa Research Program.
Well, the current state of play, as I understand, is that the rebels contested the legitimacy of the military committee that has replaced President Deby and have stated their determination to continue to fight to overthrow the institutions of state and to that end have started advancing south. So that is fraught with risk. Because this is a significant, well-armed rebel group with a significant rear base in Libya. It also, I would add, raises the question, a very important question, of whether this rebel group, called the FACT, may be able to bring on board other rebel groups based in Libya and whether they may join it or launch complementary attacks in other parts of the country. And that is a very critical question for Chad at the moment.
And what about Chad's military? Not only did they lose their president, but also numerous other generals were said to be killed as well. Is there any indication of the army's ability to stop the rebel advance?
Well, they did push it back, of course, just a few days ago and repelled the rebels who retreated back up north, did what they called themselves a strategic retreat. Now, how to the degree to which they were weakened in that fight, you rightly say that a number of high-ranking officers were killed, and no doubt that's true, but so were the rebels. So in a way, we are as we were. The second question in there is, of course, they've lost their commander-in-chief. And a very important question at the moment is whether the new military committee that's taken over the country has full ability to deploy soldiers and command the army. And that will play out in the coming days and weeks.
Now let's look at the new government, which is a military council. There are questions of whether the council was established according to the constitution, and also questions of whether the Chadian people in N'Djamena or beyond will support the council. Can you go into that?
The constitution is slightly difficult to follow because it was changed in 2018 to provide for a vice president who would take over in this current circumstances, but that vice president hasn't been named. The previous constitution stipulated that the head of the National Assembly should take over. So there's a little bit of ambiguity there, but I think that most observers are fairly clear that this is not a constitutional regime at the moment. The second point on the streets of N'Djamena, if we go by the statements of most political parties, opposition political parties and civil society, they are very much opposed to what they see as continuity with a highly militarized government under President Deby. It's very likely that the vast majority of people in N'Djamena see things the same way. They don't want to be ruled by the military, and they do see that as a continuity with the previous regime, under which they've been certainly impoverished and also protesting, including at the very recent election. So the military committee is there in power, led by Deby's son, but I think it's going to find itself very contested, both internally in Chad and possibly also by external actors.
Last of all, looking internationally, what kind of diplomacy is going on? Has the African Union spoken out about this transfer of power, for instance?
It is certainly the case that international actors, the Americans, the French, will be trying to ensure stability and also trying to ensure that the army is capable of continuing its deployment against jihadist groups, both in the Lake Chad Basin and in the Sahel. However, I think there is a risk that some of those troops may be withdrawn in order to fight rebels coming from Libya. International actors have sent condolences for the death of the president, but so far have been somewhat hesitant in making a clear statement concerning the military council and whether it's constitutional. However, I think it's likely that pressure on the constitutional council will grow, either to move very rapidly to elections or to form some sign of government incorporating civilian political parties.
That was International Crisis Group Central Africa Research Program's Richard Moncrief speaking to VOA's Jason Patinkin. You're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Steve Miller. Russian police rounded up more than 1,000 people Wednesday. This as thousands of people in dozens of cities took part in marches organized by allies of hunger-striking Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny over his failing health in jail. His spokeswoman was jailed for 10 days and another close ally was detained. The government move against them came on the same day that President Vladimir Putin delivered his State of the Nation speech, warning the West not to cross Russia's red lines, and pointedly made no mention of Navalny. A Russian human rights commissioner said that four doctors from outside the federal prison agency had visited Navalny on Tuesday and found no serious health problems. Navalny began his hunger strike to protest prison officials' refusal to let his doctors visit when he began experiencing severe back pain and a loss of feeling in his legs. Human rights advocate Bill Browder told VOA diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain that the United States should impose real consequences on Russian President Vladimir Putin's associates before Navalny dies in prison.
From my vantage point, I think he's already been issued with a death sentence from Vladimir Putin. The death sentence is for committing the ultimate crime as far as Vladimir Putin is concerned, which is challenging him successfully and becoming a popular opposition politician. And Vladimir Putin tried to kill him directly with Novichok, and now they're killing him in slow motion in front of the whole world with withholding of medical attention. And it's a very grave and dire situation.
Right. I saw that his doctors once again tried to go to the prison and were not allowed in. So it's do you think that he is in a near-death situation, or is it just impossible to tell from here?
Well, I can only rely on the information that comes from his colleagues, and according to them, his level of potassium in his blood is at such a high level now that he's imminently going to die of kidney failure and heart failure. And this is extremely serious situation.
What is your view? Has the U.S. been strong enough, been tough enough so far?
Well, on one hand, it's pleasing to hear tough talk from the White House. Jake Sullivan said very clearly that there will be serious consequences if Alexei Navalny dies. But what I find unsatisfactory about that statement is that there should be serious consequences right this second. I mean, it's unbelievable that Putin is trying to kill the main opposition, his main opposition, and that just can't be tolerated. And the medical neglect, the poisoning with Novichok, the illegitimate holding him in custody, all of that deserves a serious policy response. And the policy response is pretty straightforward, which is the Magnitsky Act, which imposes visa sanctions and asset freezes, should be imposed on a group of people who Alexei Navalny identified before he went back to Russia. He said that if anything happens to him when he gets back to Russia, here is a list of 35 of Putin's cashiers, of his trustees. Alexei Navalny said, if something happens to me, sanction them under the Magnitsky Act. Something has happened to him now, and they should be sanctioned. And the United States government has this list, and so do other allies. And in my opinion, starting today, the first five people on that list should be sanctioned so Putin can see that the U.S. is serious. And if something more happens to Alexei Navalny, then another five, and then another five. And Putin should understand that the United States is serious. There are real consequences. The U.S. will go after the money, and it's already starting to do so.
Do you think that there are maybe things going on behind the scenes, or what do you think that Putin best responds to, public or private pressure?
Putin responds to real consequences. Doesn't matter whether it's public or private. If he believes that there will be real consequences, not just words, he will resist his worst urges.
Bill Browder is a human rights advocate, and he was speaking with VOA diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain. Russia denies involvement in last August's poisoning of Navalny and says that he has been treated as would any other prisoner. UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Michelle Bachelet is calling Derek Chauvin's guilty verdict in the killing of George Floyd momentous and a testament to the perseverance of his family and others in calling for justice. Lisa Schlein takes it from here.
Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet says the evidence was crystal clear in the prosecution of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin. He was found guilty Tuesday of killing African-American George Floyd in police custody. She says any other result would have been a travesty of justice. The High Commissioner says while justice this time was served, justice remains elusive for countless other victims of African descent and their families in the United States and throughout the world.
This case has also helped reveal, perhaps more clearly than ever before, how much remains to be done to reverse the tide of systemic racism that permeates the life of people of African descent. Now is the time to critically examine the context in which George Floyd's killing took place by revisiting the past and examining its toxic traces in today's society.
Bachelet says impunity for crimes and human rights violations by law enforcement officers must end. She adds there must be robust reforms to policing as currently practiced in the United States and elsewhere. Bachelet spokesman Rupert Colville tells VOA the High Commissioner fears the significance of the Floyd verdict will become just one good moment in a long line of terrible events if it is not followed up with concrete action.
And there's a risk that actually we just fall back into the same pattern. So the High Commissioner today is kind of highlighting that we really need to now stop just talking about reform, to do reform and to make it stick, but also to do the much deeper work across society, which is much more difficult, of really trying to tackle with this systemic racism that is prevalent in all societies.
Last June, the UN Human Rights Council held a special session on systemic racism and police brutality against people of African descent following the killing of Floyd by Chauvin on May 25th. Colville says High Commissioner Bachelet will present a report on this issue during the council's upcoming June session. He says the report will contain recommendations for transformative change, better policing, and strengthening accountability for crimes against people of African descent and other minority groups. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The U.S. Justice Department is also opening an investigation into the Minneapolis, Minnesota Police Department a day after Chauvin was convicted of killing Floyd. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani has the details.
Attorney General Merrick Garland says the verdict does not address potentially systemic policing issues in Minneapolis, so the Justice Department will start a probe.
To determine whether the Minneapolis Police Department engages in a pattern or practice of unconstitutional or unlawful policing.
By looking at use of force, among other things, the Justice Department was already investigating whether Chauvin and other officers involved in Floyd's death violated his civil rights. Sagar Magani, Washington.
The leader of the military coup ruling Myanmar, General Min Aung Hlaing, will reportedly attend a major summit of Asian countries this weekend. The military has shown little willingness to engage with its neighbors over the ongoing crisis. Reuters' Matthew LaRotonda reports.
Let's shoot! Another day of protests in Myanmar, this time a candlelight vigil for the over 700 people activists say have been killed in the months of turmoil since its military coup. 3,300 people are said to be in prison, with 20 sentenced to death, according to the Assistance Association for Political Prisoners. Meanwhile, the Nikkei Asia news agency is reporting that the leader of the coup, General Min Aung Hlaing, will attend a major summit of Asian countries in Jakarta this weekend to discuss the crisis. Reuters has not confirmed the move, but Myanmar's military has shown little willingness in the past to engage with its neighbors over it. The Association of Southeast Asian Nations, which is hosting the summit, has 10 members, including Myanmar, and they're all split over how to guide Myanmar out of the unrest. Diplomatic sources tell Reuters that the United Nations Special Envoy for Myanmar is flying out to Jakarta ahead of the summit, but they were doubtful that the general would appear in person or meet with the UN.
Matthew Liratonda reports for Reuters News.
This is Science in a Minute.
As Earth hurtles through space, it is bombarded with pieces of comets, asteroids, and other space debris. While most of these space rocks never make it to the surface of Earth, those that survive the blazing trip through the atmosphere and land are commonly known as meteorites. The mass of meteorites can range from tons to fractions of a gram. Meteorites the size of dust particles are referred to as micrometeorites. Scientists from the French National Center for Scientific Research have been studying micrometeorites for almost 20 years. In a new study published by Earth and Planetary Science Letters, the researchers say that around 5,200 tons of this extraterrestrial dust falls to Earth every year. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Humanitarian aid for refugees in Turkey is scarce during this Islamic holy month of Ramadan, usually abundant in years past. More than a year of pandemic lockdowns in Turkey has shrunk Ramadan charity given while further impoverishing the refugees. Heather Murdoch has that story.
Muslims around the world were prepared for social distancing during Ramadan prayers this year. But in Turkey, many refugees were unprepared for the economic fallout of more than a year of pandemic lockdowns. Donors usually give liberally during the Islamic holy month, but some activists say donations have decreased at times as much as 90%. Aya Sultan, a volunteer aid worker in Istanbul, says last year local business people sent extra support for refugees because of the pandemic. But this year, many of the same people said they could not donate because their businesses had failed. Turkey hosts 3.6 million Syrian refugees, more than any other country. But for years, crushing poverty has driven many to flee, often over dangerous seas or via rivers and forests. Mohammed Alawas and his family attempted to cross into Europe last year, but they were pushed back as the coronavirus lockdowns began. This year, he tried again, alone, but he was injured in the Greek forest before he was deported. Alawas says the trip has left him broke and hopeless, with no job prospects. Since then, his family has relied on rapidly dwindling humanitarian aid as the children languish, unable even to enroll in online school. Marwa, Mohammed's wife, says the journey to Europe remains the only path she can see forward, despite increasing danger. After 5 years of declining numbers, the number of deaths at sea among refugees and asylum seekers has increased by 61% this year. Countless sources, including the United Nations, have accused Greek and European authorities of forcing refugees and asylum seekers back to Turkey, often violently. Greece denies breaking any international laws and defends its right to secure its borders. Heather Murdock, VOA News, Istanbul.
For over 70 years, Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Gary Snyder has combined an environmental awareness shaped by America's Far West with a Zen Buddhist perspective that celebrates and reveres the natural world. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Snyder, for whom every day is Earth Day.
With his laughing eyes, deeply furrowed skin, and unruly white beard, the poet Gary Snyder looks every bit the wizened sage as he reads an excerpt from his translation of a poem by Han Shan. This Chinese poet, whom Snyder affectionately calls a mountain madman, lived over 1,100 years ago in a cave deep in the wilderness.
The path to Han Shan's place is laughable. A path, but no sign of cart or horse. Converging gorges, hard to trace their twists. Jumbled cliffs, unbelievably rugged. A thousand grasses bend with dew. A hill of pines hums in the wind. And now I've lost the shortcut home. Body asking shadow, how do you keep up?
Like Han Shan, Snyder says he has gained personal and spiritual insights from his experiences in nature. He is intimately familiar with the wild landscapes of Japan, where he lived and studied Zen Buddhism as a young man. And he knows the winding trails of California's Sierra Nevada mountain range, his home for many years.
A trail is really a handy thing. It's a lot easier to hike on a trail than it is to crash through the brush. You get from place A to place B that way. But in earlier times, before village agriculture, people went into the woods and the fields and the marshes to gather the various things they needed. You want to dye something, you go into the woods and marshes to look for the dye plants. Poison oak is a very good black dye. If you want berries, you look where the berry patches are. And of course, if you're going fishing or hunting, you know where to go, to a marsh, a lake, a stream. So the trail is only useful to get you to where you're going to leave the trail. But what you really want is not on the trail most of the time. You have to go off the trail and go looking for it. That's true in life, too.
In this reading from his poem, Off the Trail, Snyder recalls hiking with his late wife, Carol, and the pleasures of a trackless wilderness.
We are free to find our own way over rocks, through the trees, where there are no trails. The ridge and the forest present themselves to our eyes and feet, which decide for themselves in their old learned wisdom of doing where the wild will take us.
Snyder says there is a unique fellowship between humans and nature that is embodied in one's home place.
And it can be developed even in Manhattan by paying attention to where you are, what the elevation is where you are, what the rock outcroppings might be, what birds stop there when they're migrating, if any. And people like myself, who are watershed bioregionalists, we're particularly interested in where the original streams were and can we find them again and maybe daylight some of them.
Daylighting refers to efforts by some urban environmental planners to identify natural streams that have been diverted or paved over and restore them to their original state. Snyder says concerns about the natural environment are especially keen in California, where farmers depend on melting snowpack each spring to irrigate their fields.
And if global warming causes less snow to fall and to melt faster and turn it into just rain so it runs off in the winter, that'll be the end of California agriculture. There were periods in the past where that was the way it was anyway.
Despite his concern about the enormous damage humans have done to the environment, Snyder is hopeful such practices are changing. And he's confident, too, in the power and resilience of nature.
We can say two things at the same time. We can say we really have to work on improving our style here and clean up our act. And if we don't, we'll maybe be in very bad trouble and also cause a lot of trouble for other beings. But then you can also say, given the longer cycles of planetary change, nature always bats last. We can hope that that really will continue to be the case.
Snyder, who was born in 1930, says he has a few more books to write, including a Buddhist memoir, before, as he puts it, he packs it away, drinks red wine, and watches the sunset. With the poet Gary Snyder, I'm Adam Phillips reporting.
And you've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by visiting voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.